I want to continue to talk about coupling qubits so that we can get a bit richer dynamic than having just one. And of course, we've seen that if I have two qubits, and we write down the Hamiltonian for them, this structure, and you know, this term is boring. This one is important because it gives us distinguishability. These are, of course, the coupling terms. If I have all of this, you know, it's great because it's isotropic. But it's a challenge because this piece of it, which I can rewrite like so, doesn't commute with that. In other words, this term is telling us that there's an energy difference between the states of the two qubits, and this term is telling us to swap the two qubits. If there's an energy difference, then of course it changes the energy, so it's non-secular. And we can use this term to decouple the qubits. And we saw various sequences and a bit of average Hamiltonian theory about how you could compose those and whether you're trying to suppress this term to make the isotropic piece, or this term is large, and so this is already suppressed, but you're taking this term and then creating, on average over time, an isotropic piece of that. Either way, it works. Now, the other thing that we saw was that over here, this piece, of course, is normally forbidden. These things are allowed. Any single spin flip is allowed, of course. The forbidden transition, one can make allowed by suppressing that term. Or, more nicely, you can drive it. And what you saw in your tutorial is if you take the rest of this piece, then by driving these two transitions with the same Rabi, you can introduce this transition strongly. And you can detune from that transition. So even though you're driving a virtual transition here, you'll still have a rapid Rabi between these two forbidden levels. Okay? And it's a bit tricky in these pieces to actually get hold of all of the physics. And of course, there's two essentially related ideas in this, but they're hard to connect initially. You know, the first idea was the idea of electromagnetically induced transparency that says, oh, imagine I'm driving this transition. Okay, now I'm putting photons in the system. And then let me drive this one in exactly such a way that when I'm driving this, the process that takes me there and back interferes with this process. And when you do that, then you suppress that process. And that is this dip you see in electromagnetically induced transparency. The other piece is the piece that we're more interested in that says, oh, let's take this forbidden transition and make it allowed by introducing a third level. And having this forbidden transition can be nice in that it can give us a very quiet place to store quantum information. Okay, so we, you know, we'd like to have access to such things. And Aggie's going to send you another Mathematica notebook, which is on a 3-qubit system that shows the same sort of interference, but via states going around a ring. Okay, just so you get a chance to have a look at that. All right. Now there's one more piece that we need to say before we go on and introduce a new element. And that is the dipolar interaction. So by far, most of the interactions we'll see in a quantum system are through space dipole-dipole. And, you know, if you go back to your favorite E&M book, which must be Jackson, then, you know, you can write out the energies for this. And if we convert that into operators, we get the set of operators that look like this. And so the dipolar interaction, of course, falls off as 1 over r cubed. It has an angle dependence. And so here, if I took the quantization axis for the dipoles, so the direction that the individual qubits are diagonal in, and I have 2 qubits, then of course this is the radius and that's the angle we're talking about, just the second Legendre polynomial. And here we see the term that we want to have, this isotropic term. And we have, in addition, this dependence along the quantization axis, as you would expect, because that's the energy axis of the system. And the question becomes not how do you use this for control, because it's always going to be there in a dipolar system. So if I have 2 defects in silicon, 2 phosphorus atoms, or I have 2 electrons, could also be in silicon, or I have 2 quantum dots, or I have 2 superconducting qubits, all of them couple via the same interaction. I have 2 electric fields that couple via the same interaction. And the question is, can we take and send this to zero? You know, so what I'd like to be able to do is to modulate this term very similar to what I did over here to take this term to zero. Remember, we gave a series of pi pulses to do that. And at first blush, it looks impossible because this term is isotropic, it's a scalar, and so unless you could break unless you could individually rotate each spin, you wouldn't be able to take this term to zero. But this one you can control. And there was a nice idea introduced by John Strange, but then made useful by John Waugh. That said, modulate both of the spin, A and B. In the same way. So that during this interval, the term sigma z is of course sigma z, you haven't done anything. And sigma dot sigma is always sigma dot sigma. It's a scalar, so you can't change it. But here, it's transformed by those RF pulses into these other effective Hamiltonians, so that the average of this is sigma dot sigma over 3. And now you can see that it vanishes. So the sum of these two terms, right, this term remains sigma dot sigma. And so with a dipolar interaction, so if I'm talking about an electron interfering with my quantum processor, provided I can modulate the system, then I can remove the dipolar interaction. There's another nice result, which was noted by Raymond Andrew, is that at a so-called magic angle, this term goes to zero. The average of that term goes to zero. And that magic angle is the bisector of the cube, which wouldn't be that surprising. So, you could arrange geometrically, or you can control your system. Okay. Good. I want to use this and then get to cavities. So if we have a quantum processor, we said with DiVincenzo's, yeah, sure.
Sure, sir, can you go that and the modulating assistance, you get the sigma dot sigma over 2. I was just wondering why the assistance we are rotating about the y-axis and then take a second.
Yeah, thanks for the question. And I've glossed over that. When I write down these states, these are the states of the operator. So I'm going into an interaction frame. And I'm going to go into the interaction frame given by the radio frequency pulses. So if I'm looking at this system, this set of pulses, then a rotation about x will take me to y. The trick comes when I'm looking at this set of pulses. And because we're going into the interaction frame, the time ordering becomes opposite. So I have to think about this in terms of, although this is the pulse I applied first, in the interaction frame, this is the operator that the effective Hamiltonian sees first. And so here, the ZZ term gets changed by this Y rotation into XX. And of course, this X rotation does nothing to that state, and so it remains. Okay? The other way of thinking about this is to say, if I'm going into an interaction frame, I'm effectively looking at a commutator, and I'm just changing the order of the commutator so that the modulation appears on the Hamiltonian. It doesn't depend upon the state. And that the commutator ABC is the commutator, the trace. I take everything I said and replace it with the trace. The trace of ABC is equal to the trace of CBA. I should say this carefully. The trace of ABC is equal to the trace of CAB and any other circular piece. Okay. So I want a system that I can break down into nodes so that I can parallel process. So I can perform a quantum error correction in parallel. And so we're going to imagine that we have our qubit that defines the node. And then I'm going to just draw one of them. And then there's a node for that qubit. So if this is node 0, let's call it node A, then this is qubit 1 on node A. Now over here, I'm going to have another node. And we'll put a qubit there. And of course, I want the qubits to be identical in each node, because I want to be able to do things in parallel. But I want to have my control terms here that are distinguishable. So these two are distinguishable, A and B. These two are identical, except they're connected to A and B. And between here, we have an interaction. And there's no coupling between these two qubits. Now the computation resides here. These things are used for state preparation. They're used for measurement. And they may be used for control. Depends upon the physical system that you're looking at. And the question becomes, well, if all of my information is up here, I want no information on these pieces, right? They're essential. They give me all the elements of doing an operation. But I want to keep the information off those. And how do I get my control up here? And so here we have, it'll be a term that looks like the hyperfine interaction, whether I'm talking about cavities or photons or superconducting qubits. And this term will be a dipole-dipole interaction. And the most common thing is to think about this as two cavities and those as qubits coupled to those. And we'll see that in a second. Now, if we were sitting here and we were only saying, well, I want to know if this is possible, we could look at the commutators in the Hamiltonian, we could see that it's possible. If we were thinking about it in terms of gates, if I wanted to swap those two, it would be duck soup, right? I could swap here, then I could swap here, then I could swap here, then I could swap here, and then I could swap there. So at the cost of 5 swaps, and because I have a Hamiltonian coupling those, I can do all of those. I could create an effective swap between those two. But there's a nicer way. If I look at the commutator, I look at the second commutator between the hyperfine and the dipole. And of course, it makes sense we want the second commutator, right? We've got 2 hyperfine terms and 1 dipole. Then this term has a term that looks like this, a term which says, swap the states of our 2 dipole connected spins, qubits, but only if you also swap the states of these 2. And so now then we draw up the energy level diagram. So this is the manifold where the 2 qubits, where the nodes are in the ground state. And here, I'm looking at the states of these 2. We have those levels. These 2 manifolds correspond to the first excited states of the net. And of course, the qubit information is exactly the same in each of those. This term says swap the nodes, so it doesn't do anything here. I should say this. This is what we want. Right? We want to put a swap operation on the qubits that are holding information. We want to do a swap operation between these 2 that are not coupled. But my Hamiltonian doesn't directly include that piece. But it does say I can swap these 2, provided I swap those 2. And so if I label these, it says that I can swap this if I swap that. So this is an allowed transition, and this is allowed. So under this 4-body Hamiltonian, we have these 2 allowed transitions. Now, it doesn't do me any good yet, because I want to live in this manifold. But if I want to access that, well, it's not so hard. It says, oh, I should excite the spins. And of course, the allowed states here are those, right? That if I look at driving the system, I'm allowed to flip 1 spin. If I'm going from the ground state to the first node excited state, then I can't flip the qubit states. But this is exactly what we want to do. He says, oh, good. I'm going to excite here. It will be driven over here, and it'll return to this state. And likewise, if I'm over here, then I go back. And so this piece is exactly like EIT. This is exactly like the structure you found. And nicely, because so there's a requirement, I should say, that omega Rabi, of course, has to be the same for all of these transitions. But doing that, you'll find that you create an allowed transition between these two. And provided you drive your system fast compared to the relaxation rate, you're independent of the relaxation rate up here. So you get protection. So you come in and out of the excitation manifold. And it's a messy exercise for the student, which we won't ask you to do, that if you go into the interaction frame of all of these Rabi drives, then this messy four-body term is the leading term in that. So that becomes the most important term of the Hamiltonian in that interaction frame. And it shows up, you know, you think second order commutators is going to show up as a really weak term. It shows up with the strength of the dipolar interaction. Okay, so we can engineer our control and take advantage of things that look like that EIT model in a more complicated structure to give us control and to build up a set of qubits. And finally, if I had another spin here, then I could couple these virtually in parallel with those. And that's pretty easy to show if you work through the math. That no matter how many spins or qubits are connected to this one qubit, provided these don't talk to each other, then I have universal control. And I can couple every, in parallel, every qubit here to every qubit there. Now, we don't want to actually make a processor where I have to have a lot of individual qubits. Like, it's just too hard to put them all together. And so I need a control element which is bigger and I can engineer. And so here, where we've been talking about qubits, I'm going to change the conversation, and we're going to talk about cavities. And if we looked at it quickly, we could convince ourselves that it's a bad idea and we shouldn't do it. That the advantage of a qubit is it's a two-level system, and therefore I can have complete control over those two levels. A cavity is a unary system or a ladder of states. And of course, since they're equally spaced, you lose your control over the number of photons you have. It's very difficult in a cavity to keep the photon number as your quantizing element. And so you think, well, I'm going to make the system a mess. Cavities are nice in that they're big. And what I want to show you is that if you have a cavity which is lossless enough and sensitive enough to the qubit frequency, to the qubit state, then you can use it as a control element. So we're going to talk about the so-called quantum Rabi model. Of course, same Rabi. So here, we have our qubit. And I don't care what it is, just some two-level system. Here, of course, I have my harmonic oscillator. And you'll recall that A dagger A is equivalent to the number operator, which tells us the number of excitations. In the cavity. G is a coupling constant. So it depends upon what the details of the cavity and the qubit is. If I have a cavity, it could be a dipole interaction by some photon stored in the cavity in some excited electronic state of an ion, or it could be a spin in a magnetic cavity, or it could be an electric field in a cavity. All of those are good things. And we've written this down, of course, to say that there's only unitary dynamics. And so it helps if we remember that we want a long lifetime. And we're going to characterize the lifetime by the quality factor. And the quality factor says that you push someone on a swing, and how many times does it swing back and forth before the swing stops? Okay, so the quality factor tells us about for how many interaction times of this frequency are we able to keep our system in the cavity, right? And what we need is the quality factor times G, the coupling constant, to be long enough that we would be able to exchange information. So these terms are going to be large. G is always going to be smaller. But that's OK, because we have this long coherence, this long excitation storage time in the cavity. And so we can look over many, many cycles. OK. I'll remind you of the raising and lowering operators that take this term, and I wanted to expand it while replacing sigma x with raising and lowering operators for the qubit. And when we do that, then we end up with these four terms. Now, these are the good stuff. This says, swap an excitation from the qubit to the cavity. Right, so that's the piece that we want. These things are to say, hey, create or destroy two excitations. And if we had another week of the course, we'd get around to showing that using this piece, we could squeeze a state, or I could polarize a state. So these will become important as we try to build a processor. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to take this term, which is the low frequency term, right? This is a 2-qubit term. So this thing is going to oscillate at the frequency given by the sum of the qubit frequency and the cavity frequency. Whereas this term is going to evolve as the difference. I'm going to go into this interaction frame and then take the rotating wave approximation to throw that one away. And I didn't say, but you'll remember. So for the qubit here, I'm going to define my qubit in terms of excited and ground states, with, of course, some energy difference between them. And sigma plus the ground state takes us to the excited state, and sigma minus on the excited state takes us to the ground state. Good. So now going into that rotating frame, we end up with the so-called Jane's Cumming Hamiltonian. And Jane's, if you get a chance, he has great books on stat mech. So go back and look at those someday. Okay. So the Jane's Cumming Hamiltonian can be solved exactly. And of course, the Hilbert space for it is the electron and ground states, and then the number states of the harmonic oscillator, including, of course, n can be zero. And so if I apply the Jane's Cumming Hamiltonian to a state, like so, then I get out, of course, the, you know, we're just going to get out the energy. So I get out the energy due to the qubit, it's in the ground state, so it's minus. I get out the energy due to the cavity, three halves because it's one, and I add a half because it's a harmonic oscillator. So you see that if I apply the Jane's-Cumming Hamiltonian over my Hilbert space, it's of course spanned by these systems. But these are not good quantum numbers, right? And so the Jane's-Cumming Hamiltonian, as we like, is going to mix the qubit in the cavity states. That's a good thing. And let's just write out the state for the excited state. Now the qubit is in its opposite state, so we get a different energy, different sign of the energy. That is the central result of this. What it says is that the Jane's-Cumming Hamiltonian breaks down into a subspace structure. So it's going to end up mixing states, but it's going to mix them in a very particular way as to create a series of subspaces. And we can look within those subspaces. And this won't be surprising, I hope, for you. Let's look at the case where I have where I take the cavity frequency and the qubit frequency to be the same. Right, that's the place where you expect the coupling to be strongest because a photon can go from one to the other. And so if I'm in the ground state of the qubit, then I have a series of ladder states. If I'm in the excited state, I still have a series of ladder states. But they're shifted by the energy of the qubit. And if I take the energy of the qubit to be equal to the ladder energy, then these two are at the same energy. Now, of course, these are the basis states that we've applied. And what's the Jane's-Cumming Hamiltonian tells us is that there's a mixing of these two states. And that will get two new states out of this. And they will be indexed by the sign of an interference term and the number of photons. Okay, and this poor ground state sitting here remains where it was, right? There's no excitations in the system, there are no excitations in the system. We end up with that state. Now notice what this gives you is it gives you two different excited states. Okay, with different energies. And so what we're going to see is that this splitting, of course, we'll get this exact same dynamic here. But this splitting is 2g, and this splitting is 2g square root 2, etc. So here, we're going to get a splitting which is going to be larger. And therefore, this frequency is unique in the system, and this frequency is unique. The other thing we're going to see is that this transition here is not allowed, right? In order to do that, I would have to move two excitations around. And what we're allowed to do in a dipole-allowed system is to move one excitation around. And so now we have a cavity that we can use as a control element, and that cavity is going to be able to interact with our qubit, and we won't get lost in the ladder structure. We'll know that we're here. And so the way this is going to work is we'll create a cavity, and the easiest way to create a cavity is to take a superconducting film and make it a half wavelength for the frequency you want it to resonate at. That'll be its fundamental, of course. There'll be three halves, etc. And yeah, what you want is the current to go zero here. So this is the magnetic field. And then somewhere you put your two qubits. And you arrange that the qubit or the cavity frequency can be changed. You can do either. Let's think about the qubits. So here I have some frequency of the cavity. Here I have some frequency of the qubits. And I'll take this one into resonance with the cavity, put a photon on the cavity, then turn this one off and put this one in resonance and be able to move that photon into the second one. And in that way, I'll introduce a gate between those two. Okay? Now, I'm not sure that I want to start that because it gets a little bit messy and we won't get to the final result. So let's stop here. And what I'll do is next class, I'll show you this picture, which is the James-Cumming Hamiltonian. And this is equivalent to the Dress States picture of an interaction. And when you guys learned quantum mechanics, did you use Cohen Tanucci's books? No. That's too bad. They're beautiful. There's lots of beautiful books on quantum mechanics. But this was a structure invented by Cohen Tanucci and is very, very well described in his stuff. But it'll be easy for us to go through and show you. Any questions? So our goal is to say we can take and build the structures. I guess I should tell you, if I'm building an NV center, and I want a couple. An NV center is one atom, right? Two atoms. If I'm building this as a phosphorus defect in silicon, then the wave function spreads out. It's tens of nanometers. If I'm making a superconducting qubit, it's hundreds of microns. This structure, if it's sitting at 10 gigahertz, often a convenient frequency to be around, is about 2 centimeters in length. So we can build these up. We can do it lithographically, and then we can place our qubits where we want in some other step, and then build up our processor from there. Okay? Okay, we stop here and start again tomorrow. Thanks.